Welcome back to the Curtis Research Audio Archive.
It's good to be back.
Today, we're exploring the life and, really, the incredible legacy of a truly iconic figure in Kurdish music, Ayşe Şan.
Yes, Ayşe Şan. We've got a collection of articles here, some biographical info.
Right, sources in Turkish, Kurdish, English.
Mm.
And our goal is, well, to pull out the most compelling parts of her story.
Think of it as a guide, maybe, to understanding why she's still so revered. She had several names people knew her by.
Ayşena Kurd, Ayşezan, Ayşena Eli.
Exactly, and all these sources point to her profound impact. We want to uncover the layers, you know, from her beginnings in Diyarbakır.
All the way to her international recognition. And look at the forces that shaped her, and why her music still resonates.
We're getting into the story of the woman known as the uncrowned queen of Kurdish music.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Ayşe Şan, born 1938 in Diyarbakır Ahmet, as it's also known.
But interestingly, while she was born there, her family roots actually trace back to Erzurum.
Ah, okay. And she came from a large family, a well-known one.
Yes, quite well-known. They were connected to the prominent Sibrun tribe. Her mother was Hashiye Zanım, and her father, Osman. He's really key here.
How so?
Well, Osman was a respected traditional Kurdish singer himself, a dengbej.
Ah, right, the dengbej tradition, storytelling through song. So that was her environment growing up.
Absolutely. Her childhood was just immersed in it. Their home often hosted these musical gatherings, divans, they called them.
You can just imagine that. These long, epic songs filling the house. She must have absorbed it all.
No doubt. She later talked about how powerful her father's voice was. And it wasn't just listening. She started singing quite young herself.
Doing what kind of singing?
Mostly religious hymns, mevlit at women's gatherings. Yeah. But even then, people noticed her voice. They said it had this exceptional quality.
Now, something really pivotal happened when she was young, right? Her father passed away.
Yes, she was only 9. And this loss, it really fueled her desire to sing professionally, in a way.
How did losing him make her want to sing more?
She felt it was a way to keep his memory alive. She apparently felt that others didn't perform his songs, his repertoire, quite right. She wanted to preserve that legacy authentically.
That's, wow, a heavy responsibility for a young girl. But singing publicly wasn't exactly encouraged for women then, was it?
Not at all. That's the immediate conflict. She faced really strong patriarchal constraints. Men in the community were quite blunt. Women shouldn't sing in public.
And her family. Were they supportive?
Mostly not, unfortunately. It seems only her mother supported her aspirations. Most of her family, including reportedly even her father before he died, preferred she didn't perform publicly. They wanted a more traditional path for her.
So right from the start, you have this intense clash, her passion, her heritage from her father.
Versus the strict rules of society and family expectations for a woman. It really does set the stage for a life defined by struggle and resistance.
And that resistance, or perhaps the attempt to quash it, started quite early, around age 15, maybe 1953, they forced her into a marriage.
Yes, to a man named Şevket Turan. The sources suggest this was, well, a deliberate effort to stop her from pursuing music.
Wow. Using marriage as a tool to silence her. She moved away then.
To Derek, near Mardin. She had a daughter there. But the marriage, well, it wasn't happy.
And knowing her spirit, I guess she didn't just accept that.
No, she sought a divorce. Which, as you can imagine, faced huge opposition from her family, her tribe. But she went through with it.
That took incredible courage back then. What happened after the divorce?
She returned to Diyarbakır with her daughter, tried to make a living as a tailor, but the music bug didn't leave her.
She kept trying to sing.
She did. And this led to even more disapproval, even threats from her own brother, apparently. It got so bad she had to leave Diyarbakır.
Forced out of her hometown. Where did she go?
To Gaziantep or Antep. This would be around 1958. Again, displacement, having to start over because of her passion.
What did she do in Antep?
She started singing at local events to get by, worked in a tea house, maybe did some sewing too.
Yeah.
Just trying to survive and keep the music going.
And then came a break of sorts with the radio station.
Yes, a really significant step. She got help from someone named Nail Baysu and secured work singing at the local radio station in Antep.
But there was a major condition, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Because of the politics at the time?
Exactly. The official ban on the Kurdish language in Turkey was in full force. So for her radio performances, for about 2 years, she had to sing only in Turkish.
Imagine that. Having this deep connection to Kurdish music, her father's legacy, and being forced to sing in another language on the official airwaves.
A stark example of that state pressure on Kurdish culture. But she found ways around it, didn't she?
It seems so. She continued performing live, in concerts, singing in both Kurdish and Turkish. which, you know, raised her profile.
But also caused more problems back home. Her family apparently spread rumors about her. It sounds like her mother was her only real supporter through this.
Just incredible isolation, facing family rejection and state restrictions. What prompted the next move?
Well, around 1963, she decided to go to Istanbul. She saw it as the center of art.
A bigger stage. More opportunity, maybe.
That, and also trying to escape the rumors, the pressure, plus economic difficulties. She took her daughter with her. It was a search for artistic freedom, really.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Rudbosh Hannah.
Rudbosh Hannah. Ah, perfect timing.
The aroma of this chai is just wonderful today. It's got that perfect blend of spices, not too strong, not too weak.
Smells great.
You know, sometimes it can be a little bitter if she skimps on the sugar, but today it's just right. That warmth, that little hint of cardamom.
Yes, this chai is particularly good today. The sweetness is balanced beautifully with the spice.
Perfect for continuing our exploration into Aya Shen's incredible story. Let's take a moment to enjoy this.
A welcome pause indeed.
All right, with that lovely chai, let's get back. So Istanbul, you said it was a turning point.
A huge one. Because it was in Istanbul that she finally recorded her first musical works in the Kurdish language.
After all those years, that must have felt monumental.
She described it herself as feeling like being reborn. You have to understand the significance of that, reclaiming her voice, her language, in a recorded format.
And did it connect with people?
Oh, absolutely. Her song, "Ez Ezelim, I Am a Gazelle," became a massive hit. It really brought her widespread fame, especially among Kurds.
So this was her breakthrough moment, in a way.
You could say that. She then released her first cassette featuring both Kurdish and Turkish songs, which further cemented her reputation, especially back in the Kurdish regions. She was performing live in both languages, really building her audience.
But singing in Kurdish, even on recordings or live, still carried risks, right?
Definitely. Her defiance of the language ban didn't go unnoticed. She was actually detained in Istanbul for singing in Kurdish.
Detained for singing?
Yes. Thankfully, she was released later. But it just shows the constant danger, the tightrope she was walking.
And alongside this artistic success and political risk, there were financial struggles.
Sadly, yes. The sources consistently mentioned significant economic exploitation. Record labels were apparently making good money from her hits, while she herself remained in poverty.
That's just heartbreaking. All that talent, that impact, and still struggling to get by.
It highlights the vulnerability of artists, especially women, especially those from marginalized groups in difficult political climates.
And this combination of factors, the political pressure, the economic hardship, eventually led her to leave Turkey.
It seems so. Around 1976, some sources put it a bit earlier, maybe 72, she immigrated to Germany, settled in Munich.
Exile.
Yeah.
Another major upheaval in her life.
Yes. But she continued her work there, recording many songs. These circulated widely on those informal cassettes, very important for the Kurdish diaspora. Her fame actually grew during this time.
But her time in Germany was also marked by a terrible personal tragedy.
Yes, absolutely devastating. Her young daughter, Shanaz, who was just 18 months old, died while they were in Germany.
Oh no, I can't even imagine.
It caused her immense grief, understandably. She actually stopped singing altogether for a period. The pain was too much.
How did she ever come back from that?
Through her art, it seems. It was in response to this profound loss that she composed and sang Kadera, meaning fate.
Kadera. That's one of her most famous songs, isn't it?
It is. Incredibly powerful, deeply emotional. It's a raw expression of her grief. But it also resonated so widely, becoming this anthem of loss and sorrow for many Kurds facing their own hardships and separations.
So she channeled that unbearable pain into something that connected with a collective experience.
Precisely. After Germany, the timeline gets a bit hazy, but she did return to Istanbul. By this point, she reportedly had 3 children.
Did things get easier back in Turkey?
Unfortunately, no. She faced renewed pressure, threats from the state for her Kurdish music, and sadly, continued disapproval from her family. It's even reported her children distanced themselves from her then.
Still facing the same battles, even after all that time and recognition, it's relentless.
It really was. The pressure in Istanbul became too much again, and in 1979, she made another move, seeking refuge this time in Baghdad, Iraq.
Baghdad. Why there?
Well, at that particular time, the environment for Kurdish cultural expression was somewhat more permissible in Iraq, especially compared to Turkey.
Ah, okay, so a chance to breathe a little, musically.
Exactly. She found a platform at Baghdad's voice radio, Denje Beksteye, where they had Kurdish language programming. She performed there, sometimes using the name Aishana Eli.
And she connected with other Kurdish artists there.
Yes, she collaborated with some very prominent musicians from Iraqi Kurdistan, people like Mehmet Arif Siziri, maybe Tahsin Taha, or Arsa Bawari, sources vary slightly.
Siziri. He was a legend himself.
Absolutely. It's even said he was so moved by her singing that he composed songs specifically for her. It shows the mutual respect among these major artists across borders.
And did she perform live in Iraqi Kurdistan?
She did. Gave concerts in Baghdad, Mosul, Hewler, that's Erbil, Duhok, and was apparently very warmly received by the Kurdish audiences there.
So she was really embraced there, across the border.
Yes, but this visibility in Iraqi Kurdistan, seen as promoting the Kurdish cause, unfortunately attracted negative attention back in Turkey.
So even activities abroad had repercussions.
It seems so. When she eventually returned to Turkey, she reportedly faced increased harassment and threats from MBA, the Turkish intelligence agency. She just couldn't escape the political scrutiny.
It paints a picture of a life lived under constant pressure. Let's talk more about her artistry itself. Where did her musical style come from?
Deeply rooted in the Dengbej tradition, no question. That influence from her father was fundamental. Some people even identify her as a Dengbe.
So those classical songs, the storytelling style she learned from him,
provided this core strength, this continuity in her music. And remember, her motivation, preserving his memory, performing his repertoire authentically, that was central to her.
And her voice itself, we mentioned it was noticed early on. How is it described?
Exceptional quality, certainly, often called sweet. But the Turkish descriptions are quite evocative. Yanak gorkibi.
Which means?
Like scorched, like embers, like red velvet. It suggests this incredible warmth, depth, maybe a hint of pain, but also this rich, velvety texture really paints a picture of a unique vocal quality.
I mean, the themes in her songs, what did she sing about?
A lot of it came directly from her own life and the experiences of women around her. Personal hardship, loneliness, the pains and sorrows of women in that region, oppression, it's all there.
We talked about Kaderi dealing with loss. Were there other songs like that?
Definitely. Zerbim Deye, I'm a Lone Longing Mother, or simply Mother, is another incredibly powerful one written after her mother died, whom she couldn't even visit at the end. It expresses that deep sorrow, separation, isolation.
And that song also became hugely significant, didn't it?
It became an anthem, really, an anthem of loss, longing, separation experiences that resonated deeply with Kurds facing displacement, exile, political hardship. Her personal grief tapped into something collective.
Beyond personal loss, did she address women's issues more broadly?
Yes, explicitly. Songs like Derde Huyu, which translates to the pain of a co-wife, tackled difficult realities for Kurdish women. Her whole life, in a way, was a struggle against gender stereotypes.
And then there's the political dimension, the Kurdish identity.
Absolutely central. Her unwavering commitment to singing in Kurdish, defying the ban, was a powerful political statement in itself. She dedicated her voice to the Kurdish cause.
Are there specific songs that reflect this?
Many. Things like Wern Averin Pesmerjain, Nuroz Diyarbakir, and one titled Zamani Kurdi, the Kurdish language. She was widely seen as a Welit Perwer, a patriot, deeply involved in cultural resistance and preservation.
Exile must have been a theme, too, given her life.
Yes, very much so. You hear that longing, that sense of displacement in songs like Gurbet or Gurbet Banamek and Olmaz, Exile Cannot Be My Home. And Zerbim Daye also carries that weight of exile and separation.
Did she also sing about traditional themes like love stories?
It seems so. Influenced by those classic Middle Eastern love epics like Layla and Meknun, perhaps songs like Memo Allen fit into that category.
So her music was this rich tapestry, personal pain, women's experiences, cultural identity, political resistance, traditional narratives.
All woven together, expressed through that incredible voice and predominantly in the Kurdish language. It was personal, social, and political all at once.
What about her recorded output? Is there a clear discography?
It's challenging. The information is quite fragmented across different sources, databases, articles, archives. It reflects the reality of her career, you know. Censorship, exile, informal distribution.
So what do we know? What kind of recordings exist?
There were early 7-inch singles, things like Memo Allen Vizine. Then, crucially, numerous cassette releases. That was the main format for a long time, especially for music that wasn't officially promoted and for the diaspora.
Labels like Uzeli Turkuola, Those are common for Turkish and Kurdish music, I guess.
Exactly. We see releases under those labels. Yeah. Then, much later, posthumously, you start seeing CD compilations and digital releases, efforts to preserve her work.
Trying to gather it all together. Are there songs that always pop up?
Definitely. Aziz Alim Kaderi, Zeribim Daye are mentioned constantly. Also Leyla Shishi, Lork, many others. The list is long, even if compiling a definitive discography is hard.
It really maps her journey, doesn't it? From singles to the cassette era, exile recordings, and now digital preservation.
It absolutely does. And it underscores how her music persisted despite everything.
So summing up her impact, her cultural significance. How would you describe it?
Immense, seminal, foundational. She's consistently described as one of the most legendary voices in Kurdish music. Her impact on generations of Kurds is just profound.
And that title, Tashis Kurlis, the Uncrowned Queen, it's so evocative.
It really is. It speaks volumes, doesn't it? It reflects this popular royalty, this reverence she earned through her sheer talent and cultural importance, completely separate from any official recognition or status, which, of course, she mostly lacked.
So the title captures that paradox.
Mm-hmm.
Immense respect from the people, but marginalization by the structures of power.
Precisely. Her authority came from her art, from the hearts of her listeners, even while she faced hardship and suppression. Her life and her work are just inextricably linked with preserving Kurdish identity against assimilationist pressures.
Her singing in Kurdish was more than just artistic choice. It was resistance.
A potent symbol of cultural survival. She helped maintain a distinct Kurdish identity, kept the Dengbej heritage alive, and passed it on. And her personal story, fighting against state policies and those rigid gender norms, it's inspiring.
And her music endures. People still listen decades later.
Absolutely cherished. And it's great to see these recent efforts to formally document her life and work, like that 2024 book, I Am Özlem.
By Zeynep Yaş and Himi Akyol. You mentioned Zeynep Yaş has worked on archiving Kurdish music for a long time.
Yes, which adds weight to it. Bringing together her biography, analysis, photos, documents, it's crucial work for preserving her legacy properly.
And tangible memorials, too, like the Ayşecan Park in Diyarbakır, keeping her memory visible in her homeland.
And her inclusion in academic discussions solidifies her place. She's not just a singer. She's cultural heritage.
Looking back, her life truly was one of constant resistance against so many forms of oppression.
Multifaceted, really. The familial and societal pressure right from the start, because she was a woman singing. The forced marriage, the threats, the rumors, even being denied seeing her dying mother.
Rooted in those patriarchal norms she dared to challenge.
Then the state repression. The hostile environment for Kurdish culture, being forced to sing in Turkish, being detained, pushed into exile. Even her work in Iraq brought trouble from Turkish intelligence.
And the economic hardship we mentioned, the exploitation by labels, left in poverty, despite her fame. She even worked in a post office later in life, didn't she, in Izmir?
Yes, that's reported. And on top of all that, the personal pain of exile, displacement between cities and countries, she was called a monument of suffering. And, of course, the unbearable loss of her daughter, Shahnaz.
It's an almost overwhelming list of obstacles. How did her life end?
She passed away in Izmir on December 18th, 1996. She had been battling cancer.
And she had a final wish regarding her burial.
Yes. Her wish was to be buried back in Diyarbakir, her birthplace.
Was it fulfilled?
Tragically, no. Her final wish was denied.
Why? What happened?
The sources point to a combination of factors mirroring the conflicts of her life. Continued opposition from some family members, it seems, and also the family reportedly couldn't afford the costs of transporting her body and the burial in Diyarbakir.
So she wasn't buried in her homeland?
No. She was buried in Izmir, where she died, apparently with only a very small number of people attending the funeral.
That's incredibly sad. The denial of that final wish feels so symbolic.
It really does. It encapsulates the unresolved struggles, the rift with parts of her family rooted in the traditions she fought against, and the economic precarity linked to the exploitation and oppression she faced. Her long journey of displacement ended without that final homecoming she desired.
Ayşecan's story, then, is just such a powerful example of art, identity, and resistance all intersecting.
Absolutely. From those Dengbej roots in her childhood, navigating immense personal and political hurdles, to becoming this truly defining voice on an international stage.
That title, Uncrowned Queen, it really says it all about where her true sovereignty lay in people's hearts, in cultural memory. earned through sheer talent and resilience.
And her songs still resonate so powerfully today. They carry the weight of her personal tragedies, yes, but also that fierce spirit of resistance and that deep, unwavering connection to Kurdish identity.
We hope this exploration has given everyone listening a richer understanding of Aisha's significance. Her life, her music, it really pushes us to think about the power of art against oppression.
And the enduring legacy of cultural icons. Perhaps listeners might think about what aspects of her journey resonated most with them, what questions still linger.
Definitely. We encourage you to seek out her music, listen to that incredible voice, and learn more about the ongoing efforts to document her remarkable life.
Thank you for joining us on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.